The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wigginton. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wigginton.
Good morning, listeners. At least it is still morning here in Northern California in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where the Space Show is located. We welcome you to the Friday morning California time Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you for being with us today. I hope all of you are doing well and staying safe and staying healthy for your families and friends. I think we have a great show today, and I also think it's going to be relevant to the world we all enter into when we start rolling out normalcy. May not be the right word, but quasi-normalcy when more of the virus problem gets controlled globally. And I say globally because our guest today is from Spain, and he is live in Spain with us. And they are in the throes of their problems, probably much worse than what the United States is in right now. But we'll ask our guest, David, who that's his name, too. So you all stuck with two Davids today in just a second. But a couple of quick announcements. We're operating off of the 60-minute program today. However, if we have callers, a good discussion going, emailers, we'll keep the show going, but we're planning on 60 minutes, so that's not a hard stop for today's program, but that is what we're planning. So if you do want to talk to our guest today, and if you have emails that you want to get in, do pay attention to the show and the clock so that you can, get in while we're still on air. That always helps, right? A couple of other quick announcements. We do have Dr. Doug Plata with us on Sunday. So when he originally agreed to do this show, it was really before COVID was, we had all realized just what exactly we were doing with. But we had done some programs, and we wondered what would happen if a Mars settlement or a space settlement had a disease or an epidemic breakout or something like that. So Doug offered to do a show. He is an MD, as many of you know, in Southern California, to talk about getting sick in space, diseases in a space colony, maybe on Mars, maybe on the moon. And then, of course, when the virus, we all started to realize what we were dealing with on a global basis. Doug has his master's in public health, and he is a public health doctor. And his program is going to address all aspects of that, and that is on Sunday. And next week we have a full program. You'll see it. It'll all be up on the website tomorrow. I do want to point out on one thing. On Wednesday will be Hotel Mars with Anatoly Zakin. The reason he's back is because Russia just launched what is believed to be an anti-sat weapon, rocket and tool. And we're going to talk about Russia and anti-satellite technology and objectives and interests from the Russian perspective. Of course, Hotel Mars is pre-recorded, so we'll all have to wait until John Batchelor gets it up on his website. But I just wanted to call your attention to that. And then we do have a full week of programming for next week as well. So that's it for my announcements today. So let me tell you about the program. First, toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Be patient. Let the phone ring, and I'll get you on air as quickly as possible today. You can, of course, use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. But we have a little surprise for you that may get you to use a damn phone today. So not only are we a talk show and we keep driving and pushing and hoping, you use the telephones far more than email. Our guest, who has written a terrific new book on automation, and again, I'll tell you a little bit about our guest again in just a minute, although he has been on the space show several times before, is an automation expert and knows a lot about AI and robotics and all of that. And his new book is called Automate or Be Automated. You can find it out on Amazon. In fact, in doing the newsletters for today's show, I put the Amazon link, I believe, in the promo messages. But our guest, David, has agreed to give a free copy of the book. It'll probably be an e-copy. To the first caller for today's program. We like to have callers. We are a talk show, and talk shows imply they work best with talking, right? So here's your incentive to be our first caller today. You get a copy of David's terrific new book, very relevant to the times. I'm sure when he wrote it, he didn't have COVID in mind, but probably even more relevant now that COVID is upon us all on a global basis. So you can call us at 1-866-687-7223. Our website newsletter is posted on the website upper part of the right side of the homepage. It will be updated Sunday, but you can see all the details of the remaining programs for today and this week and Sunday. And then you can see the programs that we have planned between now and the early part of July. And we're filling that schedule pretty quickly. If you have guests that you'd like to suggest to us, please send me your recommendation. If you have the electronic way to communicate to the guest email, please do include that with your letter. Remember, everything we do is archived. You can download shows real quickly or just listen off of our website. We do have the website newsletter, but if you want the email newsletter that goes out at 6 a.m. California time Monday morning by email, make sure I have your email address. Don't forget we have a store, and if you're interested in Space Show logo wear, the best way to get to our Cafe Press store is to find the pictures on the homepage of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and Pepper will guide you to our store. If you have any feedback, we always like to hear it, or with product recommendation or something like that. In addition, remember that we are a listener-supported nonprofit program, a 501c3 nonprofit. And if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you're a California taxpayer. We do have a big, huge PayPal button on the top of our website and other website pages. That's the easiest way to donate to us. But if you do want to use snail mail and a check, it is made payable to 1ONE Giant Leap Foundation, and you mail it to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And I know these are challenging times for listeners. They are challenging times for the space show, too. We still need to pay for our internet services, phone lines, computer repairs, streaming, all of our expenses are continuing. So we really do appreciate all of you who are still contributing and supporting us during this crisis. Your support is extra, extra, extra appreciated and very important for us. And we understand, believe me, do we understand that these are very, very challenging times. They're challenging for myself and my family as well. So everybody, I guess, hang in there. And we really, really do appreciate those of you who are able to continue supporting us during this time. Remember, we do have the sponsors. They have the banner ads that go across the homepage. You can change the banner whenever you want. And we can still take a few extra sponsors for 2020. But on the shorter format programs like today, I just shout out and thank our sponsors, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, A-S-T-R-O-X, AIAA, Moonwords, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. click on their banners, going across the homepage, you'll see the messages that the sponsors want you to have. And we certainly would not be doing the show without our great, great sponsors. So I mentioned a few minutes ago, our guest is from the Escaral part of Spain. As I understand it, this is the northern part of Madrid. David Vivancos is a science and tech serial entrepreneur. He's one of the few space show guests that I actually know in person. I met him many years ago when he attended a tech conference in San Francisco. And then I met him another time as well in San Francisco. So it's really great for me to actually know my guest in person. And David is a great guy. I met his wife as well. And, you know, we're really fortunate that he continues to produce great quality work, but also is willing to share it with the space show audience. So he really understands AI, and he has another great book, From Big Data to Artificial Intelligence. But his new book, Automate or Be Automated, is primarily what we're going to talk about today. But we can also talk about what I just said a minute ago, Big Data to Artificial Intelligence and AI questions in general. His full bio is on the website. You can read about it, and it is current. And he has a personal website, www.vivancos, V as in Victor, I, V as in Victor, ANCOS.com. I'll make sure that's in the archive summary of our program today. David, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you? And I know you're under the gun in Spain, kind of like we are here, so it's great that you can be with us and talk with us today. How are things going?
I am very good. Thank you very much, David. I'm very glad to be back again. Yeah, the first time 15 years ago was the first time, and the last one in 2017. Yeah, I'm good. I have to say that I must be one of the lucky guys that has not yet to give any condolences to anyone in the family and friends, so being in that kind of situation is a good thing. Yeah, and the health is right, and yeah, thank you very much.
Well, hopefully you and your family and your friends can stay safe and healthy. I did get an update from you before we started the show on COVID in Spain, and we don't really need to do a whole lot, but all of you are still locked down and heavily restricted and hoping for things to get better with the numbers and the cases. I guess that's a fair assessment. It's still pretty bad for Spain, correct?
Yeah, the numbers are still very bad. We really don't have a clear picture of the numbers since they don't give the full details on some of the deaths and so on. But yes, we are more or less all locked down, and we are trying to contain and flatten the farmer's curve. Yeah. At the beginning of that, some people asked me if I can use my AI algorithms to try to check out what is going to be the spread of this disease here. And the bad thing is that really the AI get it almost right. Yeah. The thing is, if we don't do different things, we are going to reach the same results as in other countries. And it is interesting because it is the first time in history that we are seeing the future developing in other countries. And that's something really interesting. We have almost 200 countries where COVID is doing its thing. And some of them are doing better, like, I don't know, Germany or South Korea or others. And we are basically seeing the future. We are seeing here the future, for example, in Spain, well, for what is happening in Italy or what is happening in New York or in other locations. So it is the first time in history that we can foresee the future, basically, of something that is happening in other countries. Yeah.
Does Spain close down traffic between countries? I know you're part of the European Union. Can you still travel to and from? And is air traffic normal, or is it all non-existent now too?
It's mostly non-existent. Only goods and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wish all of you the best, and you know, it's the pits for all over the world, but as I told you before the show started, we've done multiple programs that in one way or another have talked about COVID, but one of the things that everybody seems to have in common that when we are managing to come out the other side, AI is going to be a huge part of our new world, far more a part of our world than what it was before this virus got out of control. So I guess the opportunities and the new directions for robotics and artificial intelligence, they're probably going to explode with new developments, new tools, new uses. Is that how you see it, given that you're actually working in the field and you're hands-on with what's happening with AI?
Yeah, that's right. I think AI should help in a lot of ways. Of course, it should help in getting us with the vaccine. It could be the first help that it can get it, and we hope it helps. But in the long term, or basically in the world that is going to come after all this, it is going to be really, really, really important. It is important even now because we are starting to see in some cities, for example, in China and other locations, where we are starting to see robots to deliver, for example, goods or medicines or even food to people sick. So just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, I think that we are going to move towards this deglobalized world, or at least not as much globalized world as we have before. So basically, we start to go back and produce locally. We need to start producing using just that kind of automation tools to help us doing that. And in that sense, if we want to have a country that is going to be thriving in the future, we need to use a lot of AI and a lot of automation. Otherwise, we won't be able to cope up here.
What happens to our workforce?
That's a very good question, and we need to see how it's going to play out because automation is coming. Basically, the automation is not something that we can think is going to be from the future. Artificial intelligence is not here to help in the long term. Of course, it is in the short term. It is not going to augment humans only, and it is at the moment, but in the future, basically, it's going to replace humans from the workforce. So basically, we need to have this framework in mind. It is true that it is not going to come suddenly, basically, from one day to the other. It's going to happen that, and for some jobs, it's going to take maybe 5 years or 10 or 15, but for some others, it's going to be basically just next week or next year or whatever. It's going to be very, very, very soon.
Go ahead.
No, basically what we need to do is try to see how we're going to handle all this unemployment. Or if we're going to delay it using some kind of measures, for example, trying to reduce the time that people can have a job, for example, instead of working 8 hours or 10 or whatever number you work today, start working like 6 or 4 or 2. And so that way you can still reduce the number of time that you work, but you still maintain some sort of the same wage. But you can keep working. And there are many other scenarios. Of course, the famous universal income is one of the ways to go. And maybe this COVID thing is going to test out some of these things. It is testing out many things. It's testing out how well we make us, for example, work at home or be educated at home and many other things, or if we deliver goods or how we digitize the society. But if we think through how to really get this new job in mind, we need to start thinking basically that we need to be part of the automation. Otherwise, we are going to be left apart in this new world.
Some things I'm seeing that I really don't think are going to go away just because we're no longer locked in. Telemedicine, I think, for a lot of things, doctors and patients are going to want to meet up on Zoom or FaceTime or, you know, whatever the desirable program is. If you're just checking in with the doctor rather than coming in, I mean, obviously, if they need to do tests or something like that, you'll still come in. But I know my son had a clinic appointment the other day via FaceTime. He has cystic fibrosis, and they're working on lung performance tests through your cell phone so that even to measure the lung performance of a CF person will shortly be done automated through your cell phone and probably some kind of home device. So the reason to come into clinic, even when this is over with, will be greatly reduced, and you won't make as many clinic visits, but you'll still be meeting with the doctor. And I know that I have a sleep problem, aside from the fact that I don't sleep, but I have a sleep machine, you know, a sleep apnea machine, and it sends to the doctor's office every day the report on how many hours I sleep, all the sleep deviations that go on, you know, the stopping of breathing with sleep apnea. I mean, it sends everything to the doctor on a daily basis. So I have an appointment coming up, and I don't have to be there, and I probably won't have to be there even when the virus is over with, and unless You know, they can probably tell me to check my blood pressure with my own blood pressure meter, which you can go down and buy from the store for not very much money. So things are going to change because of automation, because of teleconferencing, telemedicine. I honestly don't think we're going to go back to normal. I think these new tools and new methodologies are going to work their way into our system. So doctors' offices may have less labor working for them as well. If you don't have as many patients coming in. I mean, it's going to transform stuff all over. And your book, I've looked at it online, on the online copy, but your book really talks about this, even though I'm sure this was written well before COVID was in anybody's mind or on our attention, right?
Well, I just finished it on February, so basically there are some aspects related to COVID. Yes, I was able to include something related to COVID and the post-world after we did COVID came. Yeah. So, yeah, it's not fully right with the COVID in mind, but, of course, some things are included. And one of the critical things here is that we are starting to have these AI doctors, too, because we don't need to have, like, we don't have enough doctors for all the people that need a doctor. So once we start having these AI doctors, it will help us have a better health. Of course, it is very linked, as you say, with sensors and with things that we need to carry on and to wear, so it's able to help us in that direction. The critical thing is that some people think that AI is just another tool, and AI is much more. Basically, we are now having a time where AI is starting to learn, and having machines that learn instead of you coding them, but they are learned by themselves, is really a turning point in human history. Yeah.
Does AI pay attention to borders and boundaries, or is it going to really be global, kind of like the Internet?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because as you and I know, and all your audience probably, about the overview effect that you have when you go up there,
right,
and see the world without any boundaries, any just the natural ones. Yeah, the same thing could happen with AI. The thing with AI is that AI basically learns from data, as we humans also learn with experiences and so on. So depending on the data that you give to an algorithm, when you create it, when you train it, that makes a lot of influence in the outcomes. So if we train an algorithm with the whole data from all the world, maybe it can have no boundaries. But if you just train it with some isolated data set, maybe you start having different AIs from different locations. And we are starting to see, for example, in China or in India, what a lot of people is used to be the trainers of machines, that they will have a really huge data set, even bigger than the ones that we can have in other locations. And also because they don't have as much regulations regarding to how they handle the data, how they capture the data, and so on. So that's going to be an asset and something different. But hopefully we will have an AI. I would love to see even a global governing entity based on AI and automation, because that way we may think, instead of having like this narrow view from countries or even from counties or from a street, to have this global view. Probably even this COVID pandemic, if we have this global view, it will be, the outcome will be much more different. The resources, the resources allocation, the different things that we can do to try to contain or to change the spread of the disease could be much different. If we have all this information, so these sensors connected to this AI, making the right decision, so everybody can be better off and not just a few. Yeah.
Of course, there might also be a pushback against globalism because of all of this and our vulnerabilities with China and some of this. There might be rises in nationalism in some countries, and I expect to see some of that in the United States, especially in terms of exporting industries and opportunities to other countries. I think people might say it's more secure to be able to manufacture in your own country now and not be vulnerable to someone else that you may not have a great relationship with.
Yeah, I think you need to manufacture locally at the moment. So this thing that go back home, I think it's a good thing. It was a good thing previously, because if you start to automate, you really don't need to outsource so much to other countries. So basically, even before the COVID thing, is going to be headed that way, to go back to produce locally. And in that sense, the close of the borders and so on, since not as much people can travel and can move from one location to another, you need to start getting all this thing locally. Yeah. So it's going to be a lot of production locally in almost all the countries.
Or at least with good allies that you can depend upon, rather than something different.
Yes.
You already have
the natural resources.
Yeah.
You can have the production, but if you need some natural resources, you need to get it from somewhere, yeah, unless you produce it locally and have it in your own ground. Yeah.
So you have a caller, which means you have somebody getting a copy of your book. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Robert from Houston.
Hi, Robert. Good to talk to you again.
Good. Good to talk to you, too. We were discussing this Tuesday about the AI application, particularly in medicine. And as I think your guest points out, I would like your guest to expand on not just the opportunities in medicine, but I think you're going to see an AI partnership with human beings, where AI isn't so much replacing us, but augmenting humans. And if he could expand on that a bit.
Yep. Thank you, Rob. Thank you very much for calling. And congratulations for your book. If you are in the U.S., I can send you in print.
I'll share your emails with one another when the show ends, so that you can work that out.
Thank you. That's good. Yeah, regarding to your question, yes, of course, AI at the moment is helping a lot. The doctors, the nurses, and many things, because at the moment it's just augmenting our capacity. So basically, if you have a doctor trying to decide if something, for example, is cancer or not, the typical doctor may have a failure rate of maybe 5% or so. But if you augment this doctor with an AI, you will get like much lower numbers, so you can really save a lot of more people. So at the moment, yes, at the moment it's really helping out trying to, in different areas, but mostly in terms of detection. There are a lot of initiatives regarding to selecting the right medicines and trying to find out the best drugs for different targeting different scenarios. Usually, when we develop a drug, the thing is that the drug is only designed for one thing, and you don't really have as much related information to the interactions with other diseases or with other drugs that you are taking. And in that sense, there are a lot of applications at the moment in that regard. Also, for example, in psychology, or if you have, for example, something to help the elderly in different kinds of scenarios, there are a lot of robotics that are starting to be deployed in that direction. So all the silver economy that we are hearing a lot lately is going to be very well impacted for this AI helping machine. Regarding the regular doctor or the regular medicine, we even have in China at the moment some cabins where you enter and basically the doctor is fully an AI. It's not just for some of the areas, for example, like vision or something, you really have like a mix of the two things. Like you get some devices that capture the back of your eye, for example, and let you know if you have some problem regarding to blood pressure and other stuff. So, yeah, there is a mix. At the moment, it's a mix. It's true that the first fully robotic operation in the history of humanity has been already performed. It is true that it was 100% robotically, but still there are doctors controlling some of the stuff. So, basically, we don't have yet the 100% robotically and 100% automatically operation being performed yet on a human being. We have done some stuff with, for example, the stomach of a pig or some other animals, but not with humans. So, yes, there is a road ahead. I think there are a lack of doctors in many countries. We really don't have. There are some countries where we have, like, a doctor for maybe 10,000 people, and that's very bad because they can reach all the things that they can do. So, basically, it's going to be helping a lot. It is at the short-term road, we are going to see a lot of AI helping doctors taking decisions and doing the right thing for helping people, yeah.
Next question. AI has a dark side to it. AI is a revolutionary tool, but it's still a tool, and it's how the human beings use it. What do you see are the possible dangers of AI?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Rob, because the something that you say, that AI is just a tool, this is true at the moment, but it is not true at the way we are headed. So basically, at the moment, it's true, it's just a tool. It has not the ability to replace it at the moment, but it will in the future. The thing is that we are starting to create the next us. We are, as humans, we have been creating tools for many, many, many years. We started developing first physical tools to help us with our physical limitations. Then, of course, we developed language, mathematics, and writing, and many other things to extend our mental capabilities. And all those are tools, and AI at the beginning is also a tool. But on the long term, AI is going to be challenging all this. The great shift happens like about 5 years ago, when we start having machines that can understand better, for example, language than humans do, and can understand images better than humans do. And if we understand that two-thirds of our brain are devoted to visual pattern recognition, and we have machines that start to do that better, it is really a shift. It is true that at the moment they do it only on a narrow domain. So basically they are not able to do just a fraction of the thing that a human child can do, for example. So we are just at the beginning of all that. We need to bear in mind that it is just a starting, but at the end it's not going to be a tool. About the dark side, of course there is a big dark side. But it's the same dark side as if you, for example, you nurture a child and you teach him or her bad things, is going to be very bad. The same happens with AI. AIs learn from data, and if the data is biased or is compromised or you have any flaws in the data gathering, but if you do it consciously or not, the thing is that you're going to get a very bad AI in the long term. So yes, and we are starting to see a lot of things happening. We see things, for example, when we are able to reproduce the voice or even the image of a people just like looking or hearing just a couple hours of video or audio of this person, we can then use this fake video or fake audio to make a scam or get a monetary scam or for bad spreading of fake news or whatever. We are starting to see even hacking of video algorithms in self-driving cars. You can fool an algorithm that is, instead of seeing, for example, on a stop sign that is going at 60 miles per hour, so basically you can kill some people if you go through that way. And, of course, we have seen many chatbots, for example, that have learned from our kids to be a racist or whatever. So, yeah, there are a lot of dark sides, mostly because the data that we use to train these algorithms can be biased or can, of course, inherit the bias that we have as humans. So we need to be very careful in that direction or we will be creating something that is going to be very bad in the long term. So, yes, there are, and, of course, the fairness in the algorithmic fairness is one of the things that I see more. I usually go to all of the main international conferences through the world. For example, the book was going to be presented in one of the main ones that the UN does in Geneva in Switzerland in May, but, of course, it's postponed as all the events in the world. And in most of them, we start to see this fairness of algorithms. It's one of the things that it is very trendy. Basically, we have from tens of papers presented like 3 or 4 years ago to thousands of papers the last year that I went. So, yes, it is a concern in the field, and we are trying to see how can we start to tackle these kind of challenges. Because there are two challenges. One is the challenge that you get when you build an algorithm that use data that is biased, and the other is in the algorithm itself. So basically, if you have not done it correctly, you may end up with a big problem there. And also, with the data, the thing is that you train with some data, but then when you go live and you go real-time, you may have different data than the data you have trained with. And that difference between the data that you train and the data that you see in the real world can make also be problematic for algorithms. So, yeah. Thank you for the good question, Bob.
Let me jump in with a question, David. Many people are going to believe and advocate for government regulation to avoid the pitfalls you've just been talking about with Robert. How do you see the role of, for sure, coming government regulations, domestic, international, different countries? It's got to play an influencing role, maybe for good, maybe for bad.
That is a very, very good question, David, because at the end, when we start regulating, the thing is that we can block the development. And you need to have a balance between the thrive for having a thrive as a society and the quest for competitiveness. Because if you start doing a lot of regulations, you may not be able to compete. For example, I think that taxing robots is a bad idea because another country can do it without taxes and can go, the development of the technology can go much higher rate or speed. So in that sense, you must be very careful where are you going to do these regulations. It is true that you need to try to include some of the things that we call ethics and moral, of course, and try to teach them to machines and try to teach them and have embedded in that system. But it's very problematic if you regulate too much because you may end up with an AI that it is simply not enough regarding to other countries' AI. And there is a mix. There is a mix that you need to balance.
Robert?
Yes. I had a couple more questions.
Go for it.
what is the ability of the AIs currently and in the future to act independently or for independent creativity? I have read that there was a traveling art show where half the art exhibit was done by human artists and the other half was done by AI. And very, very few people could actually tell the difference between the two.
As I said previously, the AIs, the current AIs, are able to understand the visual information better than us. In that sense, they are starting to create also art. What we call the generative adversarial networks, there are some techniques used in AI, they are used exactly for that. For example, they were able to build the next Rembrandt, a Rembrandt that basically Rembrandt didn't paint, and when they are there, the people at the auctions try to see that they think that this is a real one, because even the character and all the physical stuff was basically real. It was even printed in 3D printed, so basically all the texture and so on, it was also replicated as a new Rembrandt in itself. Of course, the materials are not the same, and if you sit closely, you can check out the difference. And the same is happening at the moment, just with art in all kinds of art. We have it in music, we have it of course, in visual art. And the thing is that the artificial intelligence and the AI creativity is going to be challenging a lot of things, because many people always say that AI is never going to be able to be creative. And as you said, there are many contests where you weren't able to decide if something is really created by an AI or is not created by an AI. And it is moving also to the field of creating also a text. So basically you can see a lot of news that you can see in any newspaper at the moment, digital newspaper, that are probably being created by an AI, not by a human. And just in the next month, for example, it's going to be an anniversary of the Beethoven's death. The finished symphony, the 10th symphony, is going to be finished by an AI, by Matthias Rother, one of the researchers in Germany that is doing it. So it is getting to all fields, this AI creativity. And it's going to be good, because if AI can really merge with these artists and all these creative workers, it's going to be helping a lot, because it can see beyond some things that we are not able to see. Even we have, for example, in Christie's, there are many arts that are already being fully created by an AI. Not just trying to mimic what a painter or musician did, but just creating new art. Yeah, it is an emerging and very interesting field.
Okay, my last question, and this is getting kind of far afield, but when you mentioned it's almost a merger between the artist and the AI, there is the concept of transhumanism, where basically you almost have a fusion between humans and machines, humans and AI. For example, the idea of downloading someone's consciousness into an AI. How realistic do you think that is, and what do you see that the time frame on something like that is, the time frame of development is, something like that?
That's also a very good question. The thing with transhumanism, I usually like to talk about things that are real. I am an algorithmist. I build a lot of hundreds of thousands of deep learning code lines. So basically, I'm in the field, building the field. And when I talk about transhumanism, the thing is that it is not here yet. Basically, because of two reasons. The first one is that we don't have yet the tools to understand what is happening inside a human brain. We have some sort of tool that is able to show us how our brain is working to some degree, but we have trillions of connections and billions of neurons, and we don't have yet any tool with enough resolution to see it at that detail. So basically, we cannot replicate yet or download this full brain into a computer, and it's not foreseen so far. Some people say that we are going to defeat death in 2014, and I am of the same. I don't know if it's going to be 2014. But many people are getting into that number. I don't see that number could be right, could be wrong, but it is true that we are heading rapidly into the direction of the superintelligence. But not because we are able to understand our own brain. I don't think the technology is going to get there in that sort of time frame. It's going to get a bit longer. But because the AI is developing by itself, not because we are able to recreate this thing. And in fact, I think that in the next 15 years, we may need to decide if we want to be augmented humans or regular human, and that's where transhumanism is going to be joining. So basically we need to decide if we want to be like the standard humans with no new technology, or we are going to be these advanced humans using AI.
If we look
at our biology, the thing with our biology is that we evolve at some degree, but our rate of evolution is very slow. It's not as fast as machines are doing at the moment. So if we don't evolve as fast as they do, we need to augment ourselves if we want to cope up. It is also true, and one more thing, David, that if we start including some CRISPR and other technologies to modify our own DNA, maybe we'll be a different scenario, but we are not there. And also, of course, quantum computing can do a lot of things to foster this and speed this up a lot. But it is really a very interesting field that is developing every day. I have seen it over the last 5 years, things that were basically thought to be impossible just 10 years ago. So it is very, very hard to predict if it's going to need 10 or 20 or maybe 30 years or whatever. But it is going into that direction, and I think we need to... We are in a very interesting moment in human history, because we are now creating the AIs that maybe one day will replace us. And what we do today is really critical. And one of the reasons for me to write this book is for all to be involved in this process. Because if we are all not part of this new AI, if the data that is used to train all these AIs or these AIs of the future, basically we are going to be underrepresented. We are probably the last unaugmented teachers of machines. And that's why I think it's a critical moment in human history.
So if we're going to make a choice of being augmented or not, it might not be much of a choice if the economic advantages and maybe even the freedom advantages to being augmented clearly outweigh the benefits of remaining an old-fashioned human. That might not be an arm's-length choice that one can make.
It all depends on the economy. We need to change, the society needs to change, not only for the COVID, the aftermath of the COVID thing, but it needs to change because if we are heading towards that kind of new world, we need to change a lot of things. We need to change the economic models, we need to change many things so we can all be part of COVID. And regarding, for example, to overpopulation or the rise of billions of people living on planet Earth, it's really a must. We cannot have the normal way of the business as usual way of doing things. It's not enabled to feed and to take care of all these people. So we need to have AIs, we want it or not.
Robert, anything more on your side?
I did have one last question that popped to mind, but...
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Since this is the Stay Show, and, you know, let's discuss for a little bit the use of AIs in space development, space industry, space exploration. I'm one that thinks that you will see solar power satellites and asteroid mining and industrial development on the moon probably in the next 20 to 30 years. I think AI will be a big part in enabling that. And going back to that AI-human partnership, would he like to comment about, there are probably obvious applications for AI and space exploration. I'd just like to hear his thoughts.
Yeah, there are many of them. Even our last program, David, in 2017 was about that, about AI. For space exploration.
Right.
But yeah, there are a lot of things regarding that direction, and some things have moved a bit in that direction. And I'm very all into trying to create this AI-faring society and a space-faring society that we will be to build using AI. I even built my first rocket when I was 8 years old using rocket fuel, fireworks on a stick, and I created also another technology for a space company in 2005. And regarding to how AI or automation is going to play out, the thing is that AI has been in space for a very long time. Space basically has been the playground for automation for a very, very long time. Of course, all the robotic missions, some of them need to have some delay due to the distance and so on, and need to have some autonomous decisions. And, of course, there is a lot of things. Also, I think that we need to go there as humans. I hope that we go back to the moon, we go to Mars, and so on. And regarding our limitations as humans, they really have a critical impact, because if we need to have, like, solve the problems of the absence of gravity or radiation or some of even the psychological implications of living and going out there is going to be challenging. The things that we see, for example, with Elon Musk and SpaceX, with the returning of some of the auxiliary rockets, that basically wasn't possible just a few years ago. If you go to any space launch, you weren't able to see that because basically it wasn't possible. There is no technology to get a rocket back to Earth safely. The first time they get two, and now they get, most of the time they get all, and even they were able to land one into the ship. And that's possible thanks to AI, thanks to these algorithms that try to get all these mathematical formulas to throw the first test to go in the right direction so they don't crash and finish the rocket and so on. And when we are going to explore all other planets and hopefully go to Mars and other locations, we need to have these AIs doing a lot of work for us. So this automation that we are going to do here on Earth is going to move to there too, because if you want to have like resource allocation or get some resources from Earth or from whatever location you want to mine it, you need to have these robots doing you that kind of job. So there are a lot of interesting applications of AI in space. And as always, AI will pay back, and the things that we do in space, some of them will go back. I don't know if the rate is going to change, if now they are going to do more things in Earth that can be used in space, but I think the mix is going to probably balance and probably will be the way to also. And my view is that probably will be the way to reduce also the space access. I think if the real burden is that only less than 500 people have flown to space, cosmonauts, astronauts, psychonauts, the three only countries that can do it. The other ones basically use or the U.S. or Russians or Chinese. So basically we don't know, we don't have yet a very good way to reach space, at least that it is cheap. And in that direction, there are a lot of research trying to find new materials. Of course, you cannot change the rocket equation. It looks like it's going to be that way, at least if you want to send a human and keeping the life between the Earth and the atmosphere. But, of course, you need to use AI to find new materials and new composites and new things to reduce the cost of reaching space. I see a very bright future for AI in space. But if you haven't heard it, I recommend it to you. Take a look at the previous program, 2017, about AI. There are some new advances in there to hear, but yeah, there are many, many things.
Anything else, Robert?
No, I think I'll clear the line, let someone else have a chance.
Okay.
I thank the guest for his generous answers.
Okay, and I'll introduce the two of you after the show for the book deal. And thank you for calling. Listeners, Robert has, as we like to say, left the stage. And you can call us if you would like, area code 1-866, toll-free, 687-7223. And we can also take your email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. David, in looking over some of the talking points that you sent me for today's show, one that has caught my idea in my attention, automation could lead to the end of democracy as we know it. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's a good question, because democracy as we know it is the way that we organize ourselves. You don't get into the ancient world, art of war. So basically, yeah, democracy is a good way to handle how people need to do the rights and the things that we need to obey to follow some kind of rules. But the thing is if really democracy is the best government model. Through history, we have tried many ones, probably the best one that we know, but we know that it has a lot of pitfalls and a lot of problems. The thing is that if we have a automated governance system that is basically using AI, we may go into a different model. If we get all the decisions that the politicians need to make, all the bureaucrats and politicians, and of course the head of the countries did, and we use an algorithm to train that, we may end up with a new system. I don't know what the system is, of course, and the AI system, we need to trust in it. We don't have, it is true that we don't have yet the tools, it's just a theoretical idea. There's a few things that have been tried. For example, just a couple of years ago in the city of Tama in Japan, Michito Matsuda tried to run for mayor using a robot. They entered third with, I think it was 12,000 votes or so. And that was the first robot that tried to go to run for mayor in for that town. That probably wasn't the first, not at the full government of the country, but at least that's a smaller scale. But I think we need to start building this simulated government environment, so we can start trying that thing and try to replicate what we have in the real life and try to have these automated politicians doing these simulated decisions and trying to see if they are better or worse the real decisions that we take in the real life. And I think it is the time to start creating that kind of frameworks. It is the time to create that technology. So once we have really, once we can really trust these new AIs, we can start delegating some of it. Because the human pitfalls and the things that we tend to gravitate to are going to still be there. So we need to change that.
You have another caller on hold. Let me switch you to the caller. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the program today. Who are you and where are you?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to be here.
Go for it.
I have a few things crossing my mind. The first thing is that I've listened to a few talks and things like this, and a distinction that has been made between the kind of tasks that artificial intelligence can do now and general intelligence, the kind of intelligence that a human has that can react to any situation. Do you think that getting to that is going to be a different kind of challenge, or what's your view on that?
Yeah, it's not there yet, of course. We are very good at narrow artificial intelligence. Narrow means that we are very good at a single domain, but we cannot use that domain to do other things. The best thing that we know of is the thing related to AlphaGo, or the winning of the game of Go just a few years ago, where this kind of algorithm can do just a couple or three things, but not much more. Maybe win like a few different Atari games, for example. No? So we are very far away from that, having that general artificial intelligence that really mimics what a human can do. Even like a small child, we are not there yet. We need to have a lot of data to train a model, to train an artificial intelligence model. And if you have a child and a newborn, it learns a lot of things with few mistakes, with few errors. Of course, we have errors and we learn from that. If we fall, we raise and maybe we learn to walk. And the same happens with AIs, but the thing is that we need a lot of learning. We need a lot of data points to teach them to do things. So at the moment, at least with the current technology and the current algorithms, we are really far away from this general artificial intelligence. The thing is that it is growing exponentially, or even beyond that, so we don't know exactly when it's going to be the turning point to reach that super intelligence that some people talk or this singularity moment. So we are not there yet. We are very far away from that. But it's true that machines can replace some of these things that humans do. Basically, this automate or the automated book is about things that we can do right now with AI. But yes, in the long term, we will have this general artificial intelligence, but we are not there yet.
Okay. I do recall you mentioned some of those things early in the interview, but okay, so does that mean that you feel that pursuing the same technique will lead to that, or is it going to take a fundamental kind of other approach to it?
Yeah, I think we need a new approach. Probably also, as I said previously, maybe quantum computing can help us go in the right direction, because when we train models at the moment, we need to spend a lot of time and a lot of energy to train that models. So at the moment, we are limited in the amount of things that we can try for doing new things and getting to this super intelligence. So at the moment, we have that limitation. And the technology is true that it is growing also exponentially. We have, like, faster computers, and we have more storage capacity to train more things, and we have better sensors with better fidelity to get a better resolution for sight or for whatever. But we need to go into a different way. At the moment, there is no clear path. If the current AI, the deep learning algorithms, and all the other techniques that we work with are going to be the way to go. Probably not. The things that we have tried at the moment are not there yet. Yeah.
Hmm. How about cooperation between different AIs? How do you see that branch of the discipline?
Yeah, that's a very good one, because instead, when we have humans, we also do cooperate. So why don't have machines that do cooperate themselves? Yeah, it's one of the areas of development, trying to have different machines, some with different kinds of algorithms, because the thing is, even when we create two algorithms, there are several, sometimes thousands of hyperparameters, that's how we call them, that you can change to tune an algorithm and make it different from other algorithms. So basically, at the end, even with the same data that you feed to an algorithm to learn with, the training data that we use to feed it, you may end up having different kinds of algorithms, some that may do the same task, but basically they do it in different ways. The things with these deep learning algorithms that we use for that is that at the moment, for most of them, they are black boxes. Basically, we don't know, even we that we are creating it, we don't know what is happening. For some things like visual information or some things, we can really infer some of the things that it is doing inside, but we really don't know exactly what is happening. Basically, because there are billions of dimensions and billions of parameters that you really can't grasp easily at all, at least with the current technology. So having different AIs that are trained differently, or basically they have different models or different architectures, of course can lead to different outcomes. It is what we call now the having an oracle. An oracle is composed of different algorithms, different computers, as you can say, or different deep learning algorithms in that case, that can make into different conclusions, and they can even debate between them. We use, for example, some of the networks that we use are called the adversarial networks, where we have one network that is trying to fool the other network to do something. That is behind the case that we exposed previously regarding to creating art with this generative adversarial network. But they go, for example, in that direction with only two networks that try to fool one another.
So adversarial approaches like that, I wouldn't think that is that easier than getting two systems to work together. I'm trying to think of it. When you say that it's a black box and you can't really say exactly how he's doing it, so having two systems respond to each other, that seems to be an easier task than having them work alongside each other. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, you're making it that right, because if one is trying to fool the other, the thing is that one has the real information and the other one doesn't have the real information, basically trying to fake the information. That is behind, for example, the faces. You can have, like, for example, now a page where it can create a human face for you, and you won't be able to detect if it is a human or not. Even they have, like, a resume generator. They create, like, a full resume, a full curriculum vitae of a person, a non-existing person, just all being generated by AI. And they use it using that kind of technique. And the thing with fooling one another is because one tries to outmatch the other to be better than the other. And that's one way of learning, basically. When you try to compete in sports, in baseball or whatever, basically humans try also to be better than the other humans. And that's something that's similar. Instead of having them working together, they try to compete. So one is trying to outsmart the other, and in that way, there is a good approach to learning. But there are also paths. You have them cooperating, for example. They are using a lot of things in robotics. When you have physical robots that needs to do things in the real world, and you have, like, some algorithms that are trying to decode things related to visual information, some other related to sound, some other related to ultrasound or many other kind of sensors, and others related to the behavior of the physical entities that move around. And you have, like, this matrix or this mesh of different AIs working together for the same common goal.
That would be a good example, would be a car, I guess.
Yeah, it is. It is a good example, yeah.
Maybe a car is the other good example for what I wanted to ask about is how much the field of safety in AI has developed to figure out when to shut it off. Is that like something that is built into a system or is that a separate matter or something that is always has to be done into the design?
You did the famous red button of AI. If we have some way to stop it by design, is that your question?
If that's something that has to be part of an AI system,
In the short term, we may be able to do that. We have some sort of, even to obey the famous three laws of robotics by Isaac Asimov, we may be able at the beginning to imprint this into the algorithms we design. The thing is, in the future, we won't be able to do that because the thing that we are creating is going to outsmart us. We have the example regarding, for example, the intelligence of a worm, for example, regardless to the intelligence of a human. I don't think ever in time a worm is going to understand what the brain of the human is doing. And the same thing will happen at one point in time, not now, when these AI algorithms outsmart us and get reached to that point of super intelligence. At that moment, that red button that really doesn't make any sense, because they have just developed a new kind of intelligence that we aren't able to understand. So I don't see it as a good approach. I think the only way we will be able to stop superintelligence is really to ban technology altogether. Otherwise, we are headed into that direction, because the thing is that with superintelligence is that really you can reach it in a garage. You can stop it as you can, or you can try with nuclear energy or something like that you can limit the access to the raw materials and so on. But here, basically, you can reach this superintelligence scenario basically in a garage. There is no limitations regarding to that. It's very complex and very difficult, but it could happen. And trying to think beyond what these machines are going to be able to think, in the long term, I don't see it feasible. And if we ban the development of technology altogether, we have a small problem that we cannot live, because we cannot sustain Earth with almost 8 billion people without the use of technology. Basically, we won't be able to feed it. Another option would be the famous big problem of biblical proportions that really rule out other technology too, but I don't think either is a good ending for us. So at the beginning, we can try to do that, but in the long term, I don't see it feasible.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it, because if you have something that can outthink you, then the matter of whether or not the intelligence has a will of its own sort of comes up, doesn't it? If you've designed every generation to have a built-in set of rules that it must obey, then either you didn't anticipate something that it, some way that it would react to something that it was programmed to do, or no matter how smart it is, unless it has a will of its own and has its own objectives, it'll always follow the shutdown rules.
That is the thing, because previously we were in the era of basically coding computers, making rules for them to obey. But now we are in the era of teaching computers. And when you teach, it is very different, because depending on the things that you use to teach it with, it will end in different areas. So probably it will end, if they have to survive and you try to use that red button, probably they will try to destroy you, because you are making them impossible to fulfill other of the tasks that they want to do. I think it's a very complex scenario, theoretical at the moment mostly, but it's true that now machines are learning. And we really, since we don't really know what they are learning, these black boxes that we took previously, it's really hard to go into that direction. If we really don't, we may have tried to put that rules, but at some point, if they outsmart us, they can override that rule.
So that's like the science fiction movies where the computers take us over.
Yep. I think that everything that the human is able to think someday in the future, whether we'll be able to build it. So it's just a matter of time, yeah.
So Lex Luthor ends up building AI, and then we're all screwed, right?
Yeah, that's why I think that book is more needed than ever before, because I think we all need to be part of it. We don't need the digital gap, the famous digital gap that we have in many, many societies. This artificial intelligence or AI gap is going to be even bigger. It's going to be a schism instead of just a gap. And we need to have everybody at least having the minimal information regarding to what is this, what is headed, and more importantly, being part of it, because we all can be part of it. Even at the data level, trying to be our own producers of data, create our own data, and start to include that data in the future AI systems that will be created. So that's, I think, what is a turning point in human history, for all to be part of it and not be left apart.
Kim, anything additional?
Yeah, I think I just wanted to ask, this is more speculative, but because the guest has been talking about so many things regarding how artificial intelligence will be able to do more and more jobs, it occurs to me that maybe an important part of having an economy that accommodates that would be the aspect that the existence of AI creates new jobs. The way you can use it creates other fields of endeavor that need to involve humans. Could you comment on that, Dr. Devantos?
Yes, yes. Of course, at the beginning, there are going to be a lot of new jobs, and some of the jobs, probably we don't even know them at the moment. There are some, of course, that are very, very related to building algorithms, building robotics, and doing machine learning stuff. There are the main ones that we have at the moment. In fact, there is a lack of trained individuals in that direction, and of course, it's going to be the first ones that are going to be created. The thing is, at the end, we humans try to, one of the main aspects that I try to say in the book is regarding to looking for repetitions. Everything that we do as humans, once we repeat it, that's one thing that at the end we can automate. If we do one thing just only one time, probably it's not very feasible to automate. But if we repeat over and over things, the good thing is trying to automate it first. In that direction, every moment that we master something, the next thing we try to do is trying to basically keep doing it. That is wrong. We need to try to automate it so we can do other things instead. Regarding to the new jobs, of course, it's speculative at the moment. We don't know what are the new jobs that will come, but they will come. Of course, I know that there are new jobs that are going to be generated in the following years, but the number is going to be slow. It's going to be narrowing down because even the work that I do, I always try to automate even the things that I do, and some of my own work I try to automate it too. And if you start to automate also the data scientist and the things work, the persons working in this field, there are things that are going to be automated at the end too. So basically, it's a loop that is going, and every time it will be shrinking. The good thing is trying to see how we can cope with all that, so we can make all the inclusive and get everything to be better off in this new world. Instead of trying to use the old paradigms, I think that we need to build new ones, because using the old paradigms, most of the people is going to be really, really bad in this new scenario, and just a few powerful people and with enough money to invest in that and moving that is going to be ending well. So I think to make this paradigm shift if we want to have a better society in the future. And probably this COVID-19 thing, we don't know where it came, could help us in that direction, because it's going to foster this digitization of the world, it's going to foster this automation in many scenarios, and it's going to foster that some people may be not be ready to work, because if you work in a restaurant at the moment or you work in some of the shops that are closed in many countries of the world, you basically can't work, and you don't have another job. You need to, or maybe you reskill very fast and retrain very fast using tools, for example, like Capable, one Capable.com, that as we get into this lifelong learning stuff that you can really retrain yourself very quickly and keep learning all your life. Otherwise, basically, you are not going to have a job in the short term. And trying to get all these people back to the old system or the old way of doing things is going to be difficult. I think we need to start thinking fast in these new models of society. That's why I think also that calling this a fourth industrial revolution is a bad thing, because we are not in a fourth industrial revolution. It's going to go beyond that. And if we still think with this old mindset, we are not going to end in a very good future.
Interesting. I guess what you mean is that it's not really an industrial revolution. It's like a thought revolution.
It's a human one, yeah. We are basically building the next task. So that's why it's not yet an industrial revolution. It spans to all facets of society.
So, David, are we going to go out and buy AIs on the market? I mean, most people aren't, myself included here, don't have the skill or the knowledge to develop or code an algorithm. Individually, you look at people around the world, what are they going to be at the mercy of what some corporation, Apple, let's just take Apple, or General Motors or somebody, builds, and then maybe we have a use for it and we buy it, or we have no choice? I mean, how does it trickle down to the actual individual citizen or person?
Yep. Well, I define three levels of automation: basic automation features, medium intermediate automation features, and high-level automation features. For some of them, of course, you need to be a coder. You need to know how to code and to program these algorithms. But for some of the others, basically, there are starting to appear some tools that help you and get rid of most of the programming. I think that being able to code is a good thing. Even the simplest scripting programming language like Python and some others, it's good that everybody knows a bit about them, because it can help you a lot. But we are starting to see a lot of applications and desktop and other kind of applications that start to include some features to automate, features to do some batch processing, micro recording, and so on. And others that start to include some of these AI. Not all AI is AI, it's real AI. There is a lot of hype. There are many tools that are really marketed as AI, but really don't have any state-of-the-art AI behind it. But yes, we are starting to see, like, once we get something under control, for example, if the image recognition is very good with these new algorithms, we start to have even cameras that include these algorithms in them, something that 5 years ago wasn't possible. Now you have cameras that are able to detect a human face and say that this is David Livingston and this is David Vivankos and this is whatever, no? So basically you start to include these algorithms and embed it even in the devices, in the hardware devices or in the software. So yes, we are starting to have these tools for some of the things that we already master and do very well using AI, and start having that so you can buy it off the shelf. Yeah.
Is the cost of an AI system going down the same way cost of computer systems in general go down?
Yeah, it is. Some of the things that you can buy just maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago for let's say, $1,000, probably you can do it now for 500 or even less. So, yeah, it's narrowing down. The thing is that AI is very dependent on computing, and computing is also going down, unless with all this COVID stuff, there are some problems with productions and so on, and it raises. But so far, since this cost is going down and the capacity is going up, yes, the thing is that, yes, they are going down. And you start having some of these AI capabilities built as a service. Basically, you can call an API or you can call some service provider and use that AI. AI is going to be commoditized for some things, yes. For some things, they are still in the research lab, so it's not so easy to get there. And there is another critical thing here, is the cost of gathering the data. It could be a cost in itself. Even behind all this digitization hype that we have at the moment, that really is the same that we do, what we did maybe 25 years ago, it's all about getting this data done. Because if you don't get data from everything, from your business or from whatever thing that you want to automate or make a machine to use, you really don't have nothing to learn with. So, yeah, it's going down.
So that's the thing about large corporations having a big advantage. Large software corporations having a big advantage in getting the data. Google has the data. So is it always going to be like that? That a company that has access to lots of data has a big advantage here?
Yeah, it has the computation resources. Yes, it will have this advantage. That is one of the chapters that they talk about is really getting control of your data, because if you are the data producer, I think you should be able at least to have your own data. No? There are a few companies that are trying to monetize that and get you control of your own data, like UPI. UPI is one company there in the States that is trying to do that, to use your data with your own, of course, with your willingness to do that, and use it for market research, and you even being paid for what you do at Facebook or others. Social media or other even connected devices. And they use the data that you produce to give you money, in some sense, letting you participate in market research and other things. So I think we need to be our own producers of data. And we need to understand that when we are producing that data, we need to own it, and we need to learn how to make money out of it.
Hmm. Okay, thank you for all your answers.
Hey, Kim, before you go, how is your area doing vis-a-vis the virus? Is it still pretty clear of it?
It is, and it's actually sort of curious. I mean, I live in a small town, and small towns in general seem to fare better until there's cases in your midst. But Mexico overall still has very few deaths and very few registered cases. So... I don't know what to say about that. It's the kind of thing where maybe we're earlier in the curve. Maybe the climate here does have an effect. I would think that beyond a certain point, it isn't that there's undetected cases, because once you start having deaths, it's clear. You can distinguish what's a COVID death fairly easily. So it may be a hopeful sign. Maybe it's too early to say. The government here anticipates the peak sometime in May, but so far Mexico has not had many deaths.
Well, that's good, and I'm glad your area is doing well and you guys are doing well. So stay in touch and keep us posted.
Will do.
David, did you have something else you wanted to say with Kim?
No.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your question. Yeah.
I thought I cut you off. Thank you, Kim. I appreciate it. Take care. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Bye.
Listeners, Kim has left the stage, as we like to say. 1-866-687-7223. I guess all of us who are sequestered, locked in, and dealing with this, maybe we should all figure out a way to go visit Kim. We can have our freedom back and be in a sunny, nice area and not be restricted. And she has great dogs. So, Mexico, here we come, Kim. The next space show programs will be live from where you are. Listeners, we do have time if you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. The line is available. Email remains drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Are you satisfied with the kind of, I guess I would say rap, but maybe the kind of education and the sort of the kind of way AI is generally presented in the news and in education and in culture to people? Is AI getting good representation, a healthy representation, or is it getting sort of what we say a bum rap?
Well, there is a bit of a mix, because it is true that some people think that AI is something different. Some people really think that it's just another tool, and we have a lot of talking about that today, and I think it's very bad to see it that way, because it's really a game changer, it's something different. But it is spreading. I think that education is changing a lot of things. We are starting to see, even at some schools, that AI is teacher, or Python, or computer language to start with, are starting to be taught there. So it is a first step. But the critical point is that we need to have this lifelong learning mindset, so we can keep learning continuously. And if we reach that point, it is no matter it is AI as we know it today, or it is another thing, that we will be always try to be at the edge of what is the limit of technology at any given point in time. And for that, it's critical that we automate, because with our current limitations, we cannot be at the same speed as technology grows. So we need to cope up using that kind of automation features, so we can really be more relevant and stay more relevant in the future. And regarding to how this is done in different countries, there is a huge disparity. Some countries are doing it better, some countries are doing it really bad. I always say that AI is basically three things, or automation is really three things. One is that you need to have talented individuals and entrepreneurs leading the field. The other is that you need to have technical resources and computing capabilities. And the other one is that you need to have a huge investment and a long-term strategy. And some countries are not very good in any of these. Some others are better. I think the U.S. is not bad in any of these three points. So we need even to invest a bit more, but it is not, of course, it is a dominant key player in the field. But there are many other countries that basically have this non-existent. The only country, by the way, that has an artificial intelligence ministry is the United Arab Emirates, for example. In 2017, they have like this ministry, and it is the only country that has one. I think that all the countries should have an AI ministry to handle all this. And this is something that we all must have in mind. And of course, in companies, the same. I didn't see many companies that have a chief artificial intelligence officer, or what I call at the moment a chief automation officer, but it's one of the roles that should be created too. And there are many companies. There are not many companies in many countries that have that. There is a lot of things to work with.
How do people get a hold of your book? Since we're coming sort of close to the end of our 90-minute program, which is we're doing. How do you find it?
Yeah, in many countries you can have it using Amazon, and in Amazon you can have it in printing. In the U.S., in U.K., in many cities, many countries in Europe, in Germany, also in France and in Spain. And in many other countries, you can have it as an e-book. In Mexico, for example, I don't know whether they don't have it in print, but they have it in e-book using Kindle.
Uh-huh.
In e-book, yeah, in e-book in Kindle. I mean, many other countries in India, for example, it's in kernel 2 and many other countries. And just a few weeks ago, I also included it in Google Play Books, and it's available in 80 different countries too. So basically, all around the world, you can get it in ebook in using Google Play Books. You can buy it there too. And it's in English. I released it first in English, and just a couple of weeks ago, I released in the Spanish version too. So more people can get with it. And sometime soon, I also get a version in audio too. An audiobook.
Go ahead.
No. So sometime soon, I also will have an audiobook in English. Yeah.
What have we sort of glossed over or forgotten, or what should we have talked about in the remaining few minutes of the program?
I think we get a very good overview of everything. I'm very, really thankful to the speakers that love this conversation and give a really wonderful questions to move it forward. Just for me to say that the book itself is basically a journey of almost 30 years in this field, trying to use technology and create new technology to do the things that are possible. I think that the book tries to help in all the fields, not only the space field, but basically as a person, even at the personal level. It also defines a methodology. We didn't talk about the methodology, but I create my own methodology so you will be able to automate your task. I give you a lot of formulas and things that you can use to see the things that you do, to see the task, the subtask, and the actions that you do on your daily basis, and to help you decide what is the best thing to start automate. And also I talk in the book about different tools for automation, physical tools, if you want to do some physical, you want to automate some physical stuff, and many logical tools that help you in that direction. So I guess it's a journey. The journey of automation is here to stay, and the sooner you get with it, the better off you will end up. So thank you very much.
I got an email from you, okay?
Okay.
Todd is in San Diego, and he said, David, thank you for this excellent show. David in Spain and the author, how do you think the world of AI and your experience and what you're talking about differs from the AI world if David, the space show host, had an AI US person on the program? Would you be in agreement with each other? Would your view, because you're in Spain with a different culture and a different perspective, be radically or maybe only marginally or slightly different from the U.S. view? Or is AI already without a border?
That's a very good question. The thing is that I usually travel a lot to the U.S. compared to California, so probably I have like a mix of the two worlds, and I have been traveling there and having a lot of clients there in San Francisco and some in
right. I know you've been here many times. I got that.
It's not fair. I'm not fully from other country, but yes, I think that the AI will be different. Some people say that we will have my AI talking with your AI, and my AI will learn so basically who I am, and we talk with your AI way beyond what we do now with Siri or Alexa or whatever, or the agents that we have. That when we end in a world where we have our agents that mimic our own realities, the way we are, the way we behave, the way we basically are as persons, yes, they will be different. They will have embedded all this kind of information. If we were able to capture all the things that I do as a human being, all the things that I thought, all the things that I write, all the things that I do in the physical world, and have all this as data, and we have a machine learning model trained with all that, probably we will have at David Bancos and at David Livingstone AIs that may be talking with each other and maybe getting up with new things or creating new things. And we will go beyond that famous thing of trying to clone us or replicate us. Maybe with technology, it is the time, or probably sooner will be the time when we have that kind of clones based on the things that we are able to teach a machine with. But for that, we need data. If we don't have data, I don't see that coming anytime soon.
Interesting. How many pages are in your book?
About 200, depending on the version.
And it's in, obviously, it's in English, correct?
Yeah, it's in English. Yeah, I first published it in English there in the U.S. in Amazon. And, yeah, it's in English, of course, yeah.
Another chapter that you have from your talking points that caught my attention, and I think we have time to do it, is what is the value of my work So
yeah, that's,
how do you value work? I mean, how do you value a janitor cleaning an office building versus the people working in the office, for example?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and there is a chapter about that, about talking how you can measure the value of your own work. I even have a formula that you can use for that.
Oh, really?
I explore in the automation part of the book where I set up the framework. I talk about a formula to calculate the easiness of a task to be automated. And if you have like a work that is going to be very easy to be automated, the value of your work is going to be diminishing over time. Unless you are part of the automation of your work and you become more valuable to your employer or to the person paying you wages. Related to the value itself, of course, is related to the outcomes. If you work in an NGO, probably the number of people that end better off after you do your thing will be the value for you, of course. But if you work at the private industry, it will be different. And if you work at a public institution, the value will be different. Anyway, the value is related, of course, of what you paid. What is the pay or the wage that you have for your work? It is true that many workers are underpaid, and many employers pay the minimum wages. So it's not a fair measure, of course, of the work. But other works have some impact on the end results of a company. I don't see any good company that has people that are just decoration in any company and doing a job that really makes no difference at the end. If so, basically they are wasting money. So basically there is not a really good competitive scenario for that company. So the value of one's work that anybody does is the first thing is what it really matters for him or for her. If what you do is something meaningful for you, it is a good way to measure value. But the other one is the value that it is at the end, at the outcome of the final process of this company, is being deployed for the things that you do. And that's a critical thing because the things that you do, depending on what you do, you can get more value out of your job. If what you do has no value or the value is minimal for the company that you are working with, you need to shift. You need to change to do other things that make at the end the company where you work for earn more money with what you do. Otherwise, you will be basically always at the end of the ladder of that. If you work as a janitor, for example, and sometime soon you will have a robot doing your job, you may be able to be helping this new robot taking out your job and probably learning a lot of automation stuff in the process. So it's not over for all the people that know how to do jobs, even jobs that could be easily automated in the following years. I think there is a big road ahead that they can help in the automation of this of their previous job, because otherwise they will be left apart. They will be basically get without any job and without any knowledge. But if they are part of this automation process, probably they will be more valuable for these companies or for others that will value this kind of people. And of course, the thing or the way that they do their jobs will persist in these new AI beings that we create. So I think we all must be part of this automation of our jobs, even if we do like these jobs that could be easily automated in a short time span. And it is true that not all two jobs have the same. Two janitors, probably even the same job, could be very different, could have even different automatability scores. It's one of the formulas that I developed in this book, and probably have different automatability scores because due to the different conditions that they have on their job, the different procedures and many other things of the different sectors of activity where they work.
Robert, who called you earlier, sent in a note from Houston and said, how would it be possible for AI politicians to be worse than what we have now?
Well, good question. Depending if we train with the worst decision that they make in the past, we will have very, very bad politicians. If we agree of what are the good decisions that they made, that's a difficult choice to make to select the data that this algorithm will learn with, then we may be able to get the best out of every politician. Yeah, that is, it's a good thing to do.
Or if one of these crabby politicians actually created AI and programmed it, I'm sure we would not particularly like the outcome. So,
no, not at all.
What are you working?
They will perpetuate that behavior.
What are you working on next? Do you have another book already in mind? I know you just finished this one.
It is just released. I have I work as advisor for several CEOs and companies, some in the States and some here in Europe, and I help build these companies, these AI real AI inside companies, helping, I basically help them build teams to do this automation and AI stuff. And I, just a couple of months ago, I do a lot of keynote lectures with thousands of people in big auditoriums and talk about how to do that. And I also do workshops and seminars with from board members to all kind of layers of an organization, helping them to automate. And I also am working in my own algorithms. Some of the time I always use it to build what I call my universal learning algorithms. And I'm trying also to recreate these algorithms that I can teach to reach some sort of, not general artificial intelligence, we are far from that too, but for example, they can help me build my next space company and help me build, use the things that I researched on nanotechnology for space and help me move forward with that and so on. So basically build my own automation of my own, of myself is using that kind of algorithm. That's one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing. Yeah.
Dr. Sheldon Cooper wanted to automate himself and put himself in a computer. I don't know if you ever watched that TV show or not, but that was actually a funny episode. So that was a Big Bang Theory, but I don't know if that was ever played in Spain or not. So
yeah. Yeah.
Any plans when all this is over with that you'll be in another San Francisco area conference?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, yeah. I even have some travels that I need to change. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, but we don't know it when.
Yeah, obviously.
As we know, it's a challenging thing that we don't know if it's going to take 1 year or several months. So some people start talking about the 2022. So we don't know when.
No idea. Absolutely.
We need to focus on digital and this kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for coming back on the show. And your book is terrific. And I hope listeners grab a copy of it. And I will archive this and, of course, send you where it is. And we hope to stay in touch and talk to you soon. And whenever you're ready for an AI update for us with space or otherwise, or even if you don't have another book or another product, just let me know. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I hope you and your family remain safe and well in Spain. And just make the best of it. I guess that's what any of us can do.
Yeah. Thank you very much, David, for having me here. I always say that you are really the key person in this field, in the space field that I love, and you are doing a lot of good things for us. I hope you come back from this crisis very well financially in other regards, that people really support your efforts, because these almost 3,500 shows that you have done are really a milestone in the space exploration.
Coming up on 4,500, I think, we'll be at 5,000 shows in not too long.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
All right.
So thank you very much.
We will stay in touch, and I will introduce you to Robert vis-a-vis the book, and we will talk soon, I hope, okay?
Okay.
Okay, and listeners, I want to thank you for calling and emailing, and again, Dr. Doug is on the program Sunday. You can already see what that show is about on the newsletters and on his blog page, which I've already set up for the show. And then, of course, all of next week's programs will be posted tomorrow morning on the website newsletter of The Space Show. Everybody, have a great weekend as best as you can, and stay safe and stay healthy. Goodbye from David. Goodbye from David to David and The Space Show. Keep looking up, everyone.